right, that's it. Summer's over, the kids have gone back to school, and thank God there is no longer any good reason not to sit in dark rooms listening to records and watching the telly. Hello, my name's Andrew Harrison, and welcome to another edition of Big Mouth, the pop culture show for the thinking time waster. We've been away on our holidays for the past couple of weeks, which means that we missed Skepta winning the Mercury Prize, David Bowie not winning the Mercury Prize, and Channel 4 stealing the Great British Bake Off and replacing Mel and Sue with Keith Lemon and a spare member of the Saturdays. Here to discuss other matters are our two erudite, educated and blatantly Welsh guests. June Rogers writes for The Guardian, The New Statesman and Q magazine. She broadcasts on Radio 4 and 6 Music, and she's a veteran of Good Old Word magazine. Jude also teaches the young people how to be great journalists, which makes me feel very old. She is the young people. Hello, Jude.
Hello.
Also with us is podcast regular and the man who put the glam in Glamorgan, Simon Price. Hello, Simon. Melody maker, veteran, writer for Q and author of Everything, a book about the Manic Street Preachers. Simon is also a DJ who has opened for the Manics, ABC, Suede, the Pet Shop Boys, and many others. His regular goth glam punk night in Brighton, Stay Beautiful, is the Toast of the Coast. There should be a club called the Toast of the Coast, shouldn't there? You should open
I'll add that to my list of fictional nightclubs.
Excellent.
along with Meat Raffle. Yeah, and My Mate Fancies You. Those are the two that I've still got on sort
the
of
Toast of the board. Coast would be like the talk of the town, though, wouldn't it? It would be like on the fourth floor of some kind of hotel overlooking the sea.
Absolutely. I would like apply for membership of that. Also with us, maintaining our sonic fidelity, is the Joe Meek of chat, the Bob Clearmountain of podcasts, our producer, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Did you enjoy your inset week of doing no podcast and having time off?
I felt bereft.
You felt bereft?
There was a big hole in my weekend.
Oh, well, never mind. We're back now. One thing that we did miss in our week off was the gathering storm around the closure of London's internationally famous club, Fabric. The beloved home of grime, drum and bass and deep techno controversially lost its licence in early September when Islington Council determined that there was a culture of drugs at the venue. This followed the deaths of two clubbers in June and August. Fabric had to close with immediate effect, and under normal circumstances that would have been that, except that this time the club and its supporters haven't taken the decision lying down. A Save Fabric campaign to appeal against the decision has raised over £120,000. A giant Save Fabric banner was seen in the crowd at the televised Crystal Palace versus Stoke game at the weekend, and the Met have been forced onto the back foot, denying that their pressure to close Fabric was to get their own back at the club for perceived slights. So is this a turning point for what used to be called nightlife in Britain's cities? Are clubs as essential to our cities as Fabric supporters say? We'll talk about that in a minute, but first, here's a dad jungle classic from one of Fabric's best loved DJs. This is DJ Hype with Roll the Beats.
Wheeling, come again, please, please, please. Absolutely T for tremendous.
Lighters aloft in the studio. That was DJ Hype with Roll the Beats. Massive and crew. It's amazing how what used to sound like really hardcore and astonishingly brutal actually sounds like lovely and melodic now, isn't it?
So you say dad jungle. What about mum and bass?
Mum and bass. Excellent. Let's not be sexist on the whole jungle front. Excellent. Simon and Judith, I think it's fair to say that none of us in this room have been in Fabric in a while. I don't think the last time I was about 12 or 13 years ago. But if you're, you know, it's no longer a case that, you know, clubbing is about the young people. If you're under 60, it's been a formative part of your life, hasn't it? The world of clubbing.
Absolutely, you know? Absolutely. It's something quite frightening going on at the moment. There seems to be these sort of Victorian attitudes kind of creeping back in just rhetoric about, you know, what clubs are and what clubs are about. There was a really interesting Radio 1 and 1X documentary about this, which was made and done very quickly. And I know a bit behind the scenes of it because a friend of mine pitched the BBC, and God bless the BBC, they just went on and did it. You know, she's trying to get interviews with all the, you know, obviously getting interviews with DJs and people who were regulars of Fabric was very easy, but trying to get interviews with members of Islington Council was quite hard, and the police was very difficult. They just did that a day before broadcast. And she was saying it's quite interesting, some of the stuff that didn't go into the programme, actually, about some of the attitudes that the Met have about the drugs testing that's been used in different countries, you know, where people can go and check that the drugs are okay. You know, there are some quite progressive police forces around the country, but according to this documentary, the Met isn't one of them.
Mm. Sam, what do you think people are so keen to keep Fabric in particular open?
Well, I think a certain generation of people in the media have fond memories of going there in the 90s or whatever, but I do think it's significant of a broader trend. It's this kind of donut effect that's going on in cities now, where sort of edgy areas or entertainment districts are being forced out to the fringes, and the centre of town is just turning into kind of, it's a Starbuckization of the centre of every major city, really, isn't it? Yeah. It's all sort of boutique hotels and all bar one, slug and lettuce, Starbucks and all that kind of stuff.
But it's that classic thing, isn't it? It's, you know, when Fabric first opened, it literally was nothing around there, yeah, except for the meat market and that pub, the Fox, is it, that opens at kind of 6 o'clock in the morning to cater to people who work on in the market, and there was nothing else there.
Yeah,
it brings in the life, doesn't it?
There is, you know, you walk down that the strip that Fabric is on, and there's restaurants and cafes and bars, all there. Essentially, because of Fabric,
you would imagine city authorities would actually encourage clubs to open in horrible places in order to.
But it's the same as, you know, the same thing happened with the Blue Note. That there was nothing. You know, you used to go to Hoxton Square before it was the Blue Note, and it was the Bass Clef, and Giles Peterson used to play there, and there was kind of like dance nights, but it was essentially a jazz club. And literally, there was nothing there. Mm. There was nothing there. The bit down the side of the Bass Clef was a kind of bombed out car park that had been there since since the Second World War. And you look around there now, and it's an amazing kind of hub of different kind of entertainment venues, but the club isn't there.
Yeah.
You know, the club is now a Bill's Bistro or whatever.
It's a side effect of the kind of panzer tank-like role of gentrification, which never ceases, which, you know, is that, people are attracted to the area. You get rich idiots moving into luxury flats directly above nightclubs, and then they're surprised that there's some noise. Yeah. You get a similar thing with football, actually. People moving into houses near Craven Cottage, Fulham's ground, and complaining that there are football crowds. Well, duh.
Have you heard the Curzon Mayfair is going to close because people have been complaining about the sounds of films for who are in flats above it, you know? So then this isn't even, you know, club culture. This is in the edge. This is the Curzon Mayfair, where you can get a glass of Prosecco when you're watching your, you know, drama.
Listeners elsewhere in the world may not be aware of what the Curzon is. It's basically it's pretty much the best art house cinema in
it's
London.
It's beautiful. It's full of, you know, quite not particularly edgy alternative people. It's it's this cultural institution.
Isn't it a listed building as well?
It's a listed building. It's beautiful. Yeah. But it's just this quietening down of any culture. So it's a much broader issue than clubs, but obviously clubs are at the cutting edge of that kind of stuff, so they're almost being shut. You know, there's so many other places in London and other cities across the country that have been, you know, kind of threatened with the stuff that Simon's saying about. Night and day in Manchester had problems as well.
I mean, in Brighton, since I've been living there the last 9 years, we're in double figures now of venues I can think of that have shut down. A lot of that is to do with people complaining about noise. And I'm really sensitive to the idea of noise nuisance. We all hate it ourselves if, you know, they're idiots going up and down the streets, like, you know, honking horns and revving motorbikes and stuff like that. But, you know, if you move to an area and you know very well that you're upstairs from a nightclub, I think you've got to accept that it goes with the territory.
There was that really good photo that was put around on Twitter, and I think it was a real sign in a pub, but it may have been a kind of made up one, saying, will patrons please remember that when they get told off by people for leaving noisily late at night, the people have been getting drunk in this venue for a lot longer than anyone has been living above it in a posh flat.
To be fair, the whole thing with Fabric wasn't really about noise nuisance. It is about the drug issue in the club and the two lads who died earlier in the year. And I suppose you have to ask, I mean, much as nobody can deny that Fabric is this massive asset to the world of dance music and a massive attraction for people to come to London, if the club has been in breach of its license several times, and whatever measures it's taken to stop the drug issue from taking hold of there haven't worked, what are the licensing authorities supposed to do?
But what they did do, what Fabric did do, was they complied with all the restrictions that were put on them when their license was reviewed. Yeah. So they had to bring in, and I think this is correct, they had to bring in a really expensive external company to provide kind of sniffer dogs.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, you know, it's not, if you're running a venue, you don't want your customers to have to kind of essentially pass through really, you know, the same sort of security that you have to pass through when you're going visiting someone in a prison.
Yeah.
It's not really conducive to a to a good night out.
Yeah, but don't you think a lot of this comes down to social class as well? Like this kind of horror of the kind of ruffians who, in the eyes of the authorities, presumably frequent dance clubs. People die at Glastonbury. People have died at Glastonbury from drugs. There have been, sexual assaults at rock festivals and so on. Nobody talks about shutting those down. You know, it's all about the kind of people who were some undesirable element who are being brought to now what is quite a sort of supposedly desirable part of town.
Well, I mean, ironically, also, Fabric is kind of a student London on the techno nights and kind of very much the sons and daughters of the middle classes. I mean, okay, you've got grime nights and dubstep nights with a much more ethnically diverse thing. But the focus on the drug side definitely seems to be on the middle class white kids.
Yeah, but that's a kind of excuse though, isn't it? There was a whole thing kind of over the last 10 years about grime nights and kind of nights that were aimed at black music subculture being kind of frozen out of and shut down and excuses. Yeah. You know, that was one of the reasons that Plastic People had to shut down in Shoreditch. And you know, it's a very insidious situation that we're in.
I mean, Fabric are appealing against this decision, and I've never seen a groundswell around a venue like this in 30 years. The last time I saw a groundswell like this was when Six Music was going to be closed down, and then it didn't. Do we think they've got a shot at... obviously, they've got the backing of Sadiq Khan.
I've got to say, I think the Met Police are slightly more steely in their resolve than the governors of the BBC.
Well, you've probably got a point there, but I mean, there has to come a moment where, as Simon mentioned earlier, the endless progression of things closing down has to stop, because otherwise we're going to end up with a city that people want to move into an executive luxury flat to enjoy facilities that are no longer there.
I've got to say, I'm pessimistic about it. I mean, here we are sat in Soho now. We've seen what's happened to Soho. You know, there's the Save Our Soho campaign. And personally, I moved to London in the mid-80s where it still had a slight edge of... If you've ever seen the soft cell film, Non-Stop Exotic Video Show, that kind of slightly... seedy, but you're basically safe, but that kind of feel to it, that's what drew people to London in the first place, and it's not there anymore. And again, if you look at Tin Pan Alley, Denmark Street, what's happened to that?
Not there anymore.
there was a big campaign to try and save that, which is why I'm pessimistic. You had all kinds of luminaries from the world of music standing up and saying we have to save Denmark Street.
Does this prove then finally that ultimately the natural home of raving and dancing is actually rooms over pubs, where you can't have a gigantic sprung dance floor in a huge place with 2,000 people because you're never going to be able to keep out the things that are inevitably going to close your club?
As a wet indie kid, I spent most of my clubbing days in rooms above pubs, to be honest. Dancing very drunk to Northern Soul records or Sarah records, whatever.
You're going to get a situation where young people are not going to be moving into London. Because there's it's really expensive, and B, there's nothing for them.
Well, it's basically except playground for the rich now, for the super
but
rich.
But I'm quite kind of optimistic that I do think that hopefully will mean that they will move to other cities, and other cities will kind of have those scenes. I mean, I live quite near Nottingham, and there is a really great kind of underground dance scene happening in warehouses and art studio spaces, and kind of like it feels a really vibrant thing.
I hope so, yeah, because I love reading biographies from people who are around in the punk era, like Viv Albertine and Steve Strange, Boy George, all these kind of people. And one thing that really comes home to you when you read these books is that central London was this kind of semi-derelict wasteland where you could just live in a squat in like Warren Street or something like that, bang in the middle of town. And you could be sort of partying with aristocrats and sort of punk rock superstars side by side. And that kind of mix of cultures isn't going to happen. It'll just be the aristocrats now.
Okay, well, let's move on. Best of luck to Fabric. I think we're all hoping that they manage to turn it around. But let's move on to something completely different. Autumn means the annual albums logjam, as record labels grab the one time of the year when people might actually buy some records. In a minute, we'll be talking about the second album by Maidstone Punk's Slaves and Toy, the first album in 7 years by Swiss electronic Playboy's Yellow. But first, a record that came out a couple of weeks ago, Skeleton Tree by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. Given the circumstances of its release, it's almost impossible to review objectively, but we've had time to digest it, and we're going to give it a try. First, from Skeleton Tree, here is Rings of Saturn.
Upside down and inside out, and only high, and dangles herself like a child's dream from the ring of sin.
Rings of Saturn by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds from the current album Skeleton Tree. Did we detect a bit of millennial whoop in there, I think? Whoa. Simon, there used to be a running gag that Nick Cave has made his album again, but that's definitely not the case with this one, is it? And not just the horrible circumstances of its recording. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, as you know, I've been a Nick Cave fan going way back to his work with the Birthday Party, and talking in really broad brushstrokes, there is basically a joke that he makes two albums. You know, I think he's made his album again is a bit harsh, but yeah, he makes his kind of feral, deranged album, or he makes his kind of thoughtful, tranquil album, and this is kind of the latter, isn't it? It's interesting you mentioned before we played the track that it's almost impossible to review. I did wonder if this album is now unreviewable. Certainly, it'll be the most analysed or overanalysed Nick Cave album ever. Mm. I didn't see the film. The film, is it One More Time With Feeling?
Once More With Feeling.
I was actually on holiday when it came out, and I've been unable to see it. And at the time, I was disappointed by that, but I'm actually quite glad because it's allowed me to come to the album without all that kind of baggage. Yeah. And I think one thing we've got to remember here is that the songs were largely written before the terrible thing happened. His son, for listeners who don't realise, his son died falling from a cliff in Brighton. Clearly, you know, the recording of the album was made under that cloud, but the songs themselves were already written. So you almost get this kind of voyeurism there, don't you? This kind of emotional porn, almost, of people listening to every little crack in his voice and thinking, is he now imbuing these lyrics with a meaning that they didn't originally have, and that sort of thing.
However, you know, I do understand and agree with that opinion to a certain extent, but, you know, after the record is made, it gets structured, it gets curated, it gets put in order. And when an album starts with "He fell from the sky," you know, you can't not, you know, kind of understand the impact of that. You know, if you've just read a couple of news stories about it, that will go, whoa, you know. It's funny you're saying this is his tranquil record. To me, kind of the tracks that really work best are the ones that have this Warren Ellis juddering dread kind of going on in the background, and this kind of droniness, the kind of... like this stuttering, really anxious, electronic menace about it. And that affected me more than, some of the latter tracks, which are, there's the track with the soprano, which is really beautiful. But to me, that felt too, willfully kind of like, obviously we all feel terribly self in the cave, but the songs that were really kind of, rasping and difficult sonically, I found were really interesting thinking about them in the context of,
I mean, the lyrical
this circus that we're in the middle of.
The lyrical concerns circus haven't really changed, have they?
You know, no, I mean, that's true.
There's a lot of kind of biblical imagery. There's a lot of kind of really morbid humour. I mean, the line that I just keep on thinking is just such a brilliant line is like, I had a hard blues in the supermarket queue, which is just like, just brilliant, and stands up with, and his writing is fantastic. I think Simon's right, it's the performance that people are kind of examining. But going back to listen to previous stuff, because you were talking before about the glitch, Jude, and it's interesting going back to kind of like The Firstborn Is Dead and hearing quite a lot of the same styles, but they're done without electronics. They're done with kind of Blixer Bargeld's guitar, and it's very analog, but it's just as, it's just interesting how that sound has been updated with the advent of kind of electronics and, but I don't think it's a problem, because I think what he does is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
It's not that different. The reading that we're putting on it is different.
I think you're absolutely right. The themes of kind of religion and lust and desire and, global collapse and death and so on, it's all there. And I really hate that kind of biographical school of music criticism, which tries to read every record as if, it's kind of unfiltered experience. Yeah. It's actually insulting to the artist because they are artists. They're creating art. Yeah. And to basically say that whether they like it or not, whether they intend it or not, they are somehow expressing something of their personal life. I do think that's an insult to the artist.
There's been a couple of artists, though, who have made records that they've said these are personal in the last... Well, I know Bowie didn't say the Black Star was personal, but we found out that,
Black Star's a really interesting comparison with this.
Yeah, absolutely.
There was about 3 days when Black Star was out there in the world, we could all listen to it, and nobody knew that he was terminally ill. And then he died, and it put a different spin on the whole thing.
Yeah.
Now, that's happened with the Nick Cave album, except, we all knew the terrible thing beforehand, so that's the spin that's been put on this album, which in his mind, or in his notebook, pretty much already existed.
Yeah. I'm not sure I entirely agree that. I mean, I think, Matt, you were just saying that, he does musical things now in a different way, but they're the same root item. It's the same effect, but done electronically or with contemporary production and stuff. I'm not sure that he is that he's essentially singing about the same stuff that he did when he started out. To me, what's great about Nick Cave is that he is pretty much the only grizzled grown-up of this of this generation. He is the Leonard Cohen of now. He is, you know, as a semi-knackered middle-aged man, I find myself relating to Nick Cave, you know, more than I do to...
Had a hard blues in the supermarket, kid?
I am the unexpected item in the bagging area. But, you know, he can actually get to what it's to those issues of doubt and fear and mortality and loss and all the miserable shit that comes on you the older you get. He's the kind of guy who can make it comprehensible, if not necessarily bearable, which most artists, one way or another, even unconsciously, are singing or playing about being young or imagining or remembering when they were young, and he's not. And it's almost since he started out, he's been imagining.
But I would say that it's probably because, again, going back to kind of like the early kind of kicking against the pricks and Firstborn Who's Dead, he's kind of like always been taken as his role model, a kind of blues man.
Yeah.
And blues men just go on. Yeah, and all the shit that's thrown at them and all the horror that happens in their life, they just go on.
And you're not a proper blues man until you're 70 anyway, are you?
Well,
everything else is apprenticeship.
Yeah.
And Nick Cave sort of, has followed that, you know, looking at them. I'm finding humour in the misery of life as well.
You know what, though? I've always admired the way he's managed to keep his personal life and his artistic life separate. Because I live in Brighton, and if you live in Brighton, spotting Nick Cave, kind of Nick Cave I Spy, is a kind of game that everyone plays. Where have you seen him? You know, which restaurant has he been seen in?
He stood at my friend's foot once.
Did he?
Yeah. Wow. In a supermarket queue.
That was the blues, the hard blues.
Yeah. But, you know, you'd often see him, and this is really poignant now, but you'd often see him around town with his two sons.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that, you know, he would just be this kind of completely normal dad. You know, you'd hear that he'd been seen on the beach wearing a Hawaiian shirt paddling with his kids, or he'd been at some pantomime in the theatre with a big foam hand waving in the air, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, which is completely at odds with his, you know, his kind of morbid image that he has.
King of the Goths image.
But, you know, I saw him not long after the terrible thing happened. I saw him out and about at a Benjamin Clementine gig in Brighton and said hello. And it's the great unmentionable. I don't know the guy enough to, you know, I couldn't say I'm sorry for your loss, you know. You can't say anything, but I really admire him for just fronting it out and thinking, right, the thing to do is just to go forward and to make this record, and he's made it.
Yeah.
An absolute, you know, admiration to him for that. I think
it's a very beautiful record, and I really I'm not sure you can say you enjoy it, but I definitely love listening to it. I think should it be anybody's first Nick Cave record if you haven't? What should be everybody's first Nick Cave record?
Ooh, Tender Prey or Henry's Dream. Those are my two.
I was going to say, I bet you say Henry's Dream. See, I'm kind of like a Let Love In era.
I'd even go for Dig Lazarus Dig, which is...
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Abattoir Blues.
Yeah, terrible. Abattoir Blues.
Basically, you should just buy them all, Okay, well, from painful introspection to its precise opposite, Yellow were one of electronic music's pioneering acts when they arrived in 1980, and yet they're still mostly remembered for Oh Yeah from the Ferris Bueller soundtrack and all those countless commercials. The duo of millionaire, industrialist, professional poker player and former Swiss national golf team member Dieter Meyer and former truck driver Boris Blank, they're back for their first album in 7 years, and it's called Toy. Is it any good? Well, we're going to find out after this track. This is called Tool of Love. That was Yellow and Tool of Love. I wonder what that's about. Jude, that was pretty unmistakable, was it? Absolutely couldn't be anybody else. I was waiting for a big oh yeah in the middle.
I know, it's fantastic. I love Yellow. What an antidote to the Cave record. What I love about them is, you know, they're in their 60s. You see the cover of the record, and it's one of them's got a colander on his head, and the other one's got a saucepan. They just don't care. And there was a fantastic interview with them on Six Music, and they were talking about how they work. And Boris, this is just this week, and how Boris likes to be left alone in the studio. He said, "I like to be left in the studio like a monk." And Dieter went, "Yes, like a monk waiting for nuns," which I loved. But there's this kind of they don't work together, which I didn't know before that point. You know, they kind of work completely separately because they've tried and it doesn't work. But there's this playfulness, this fun. And I always think, well, this record made me think again of, you know, Len Cohen when he did I'm Your Man, that kind of electronic period, and he's going to be very funny and very dark, and just that the you know, Dieter's voice is just more and more and more like
that's
that.
Just
now.
I was just thinking of, like, you know, First We Take Manhattan. It was just the way he just speaks really kind of dryly, but with this amazing kind of deep voice. It's like, you know.
The instrumental setting is totally unmistakable, isn't it, Sam? You know, that kind of, you know, the little jazz picky guitar, those like weird little synth pads, the sort of bossing over cha-cha thing hasn't changed, and yet there's nothing wrong with it not changing.
I think they occupy an interesting space in kind of synth pop history in that they came directly before all the sort of great synth duos of the 80s, but directly after Sparks and Giorgio Moroder. I was going to say Yellow are a poor man's Sparks, but they're clearly very rich man's Sparks. I think that, you know, that in itself makes them interesting. I think Dieter Meier is a kind of index of how pop has changed over the last 35 years in that, you know, all the early articles you read about Yellow, everyone's fascinated. It's this curio that he's an aristocrat making pop music. Nowadays, it's a curio if you're not an aristocrat making pop music. I interviewed the band Wild Beast recently, and they said that everywhere they go, people are slightly amazed that they went to comprehensive school. Like, oh, you poor things, you know. So that's kind of... But I do like the fact that they're making... Yellow are making music... you know, you've got people like the Vaccine Zone half of Chelsea, but they sound completely boring, you know. Yellow are making interesting music because they can afford to. They're not driven by any commercial impulse. And, you know, it is a kind of wing of Dieter Meier's conceptual art. Have you seen that? There's this amazing photo of him in about 1970. He's at some party in New York, and he's doing this thing where he's standing there with a gun, and there's a sign at his feet saying, "This man will not shoot." And he's just standing there staring straight ahead, sort of intimidating the party guests and stuff like that. So I kind of view everything that Yellow do through that kind of prism, that it's... And I haven't always liked it. I didn't like Oh Yeah. You know, there was a time, because it was in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and there was a time in the 80s and early 90s where you could not watch British TV without that being used as a bed for a trailer. Everywhere. And also it's my head in.
And it's the music for Duffman on The Simpsons, isn't it? You know, like it? Duffman. You're right. I mean, I like that tune a lot more than you do, but it's, to an extent, it's their albatross. It's their creek.
That and The Race as well. But this album is, because those songs are kind of irritants in some ways. You know, they're earworms, they really get stuck. You know, they make you itch, but this actually gets under your skin in a more subtle way. It's a grower, I'd say, this album. Yeah.
I think the big signifiers in the name of the album, because it, you know, toy, it is playful, and that's what they do, and they don't really do anything seriously. You'd be kind of quite worried if a Yellow song came out decrying the state of kind of international banking from a kind of like,
but there's nothing quite so serious as entertainment, you know. To me, they're always a showbiz band, you know, those fantastic duets that, you know, when, you know, Shirley Bassey and Billy McKenzie, the male Shirley Bassey, you know, were just fantastic pieces of you know, ultra glam, ultra dramatic, almost not really pop music. You know, you could have imagined it coming out in 1930 with a similar kind of orchestration.
Although it's interesting, they've got guest vocalists on this album, but they're not big names. It's Malia and Fifi Wrong. The latter particularly.
She's on the Skepta record, isn't she? I was reading. So it's kind of interesting that they're working with younger artists. But I think
both British as well.
And that the playfulness about them, that's what makes them feel really fresh. You know, just, I was listening to it and thought, you know, Tutti Frutti by New Order. It's like, it's Yellow, isn't it? It's got a block of Tutti Frutti. It's basically that's what they've used.
I would love New Order sort of fresh to revoice that.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
Just saying Tutti Frutti. God, I mean, to me, and the reason this sounded so fresh is that they are, it's the Euro-ness of them. It's the European-ness. And to me, they're the missing link between, you know, people like Falco and Jean-Michel Jarre that we also turn our noses up at. No, they're not cool. But actually, they're fantastically inventive and fantastically exciting. They're only because they're not British or American, they didn't get the credits. It's the missing link between them and the cool stuff like New Order and the Pet Shop Boys. One thing that stuck out to me, which was quite surprising, is that there are a couple of tracks that don't fit the full Yellow template, and one particularly sounded like Underworld to me, a track called 30,000 Days with muttering subconscious voice.
And that is the one that feels slightly about aging and mortality, you know, it's kind of like, and it's sort of like, I've lived my life and all this kind of stuff. But yeah, it did really sound like Underworld. I didn't make that connection, But, you know, they're knocking on a bit, aren't they? Sorry, Underworld, I love you.
Okay, right, time for the thematic squeal of tyres once again, as we move on to another album, from Sophisticated Zurich to the Mean Street streets of Maidstone in Kent and Slaves, confirming that punk's not dead. Laurie Vincent and Isaac Holman play the sharp, sharp, noisy rock music of with authentic on the Dole accents. Their second album is produced by Mike D of the Beastie Boys, and it's called Take Control, which sounds a bit Brexit to me. What do we make of it? Well, we're going to find out after this track. This is called Spit It Out. Sucking on a sour. Wake up, Grandad. That was Spit It At by Slaves from the second album, Take Control. Simon, you love your punk rock.
I do love my punk rock. Yeah, yeah. I've been down a punk rock rabbit hole lately. I can't even imagine what that would look like.
that's another one of your clubs that you should open, punk rock rabbit hole.
Absolutely. And so this is very timely, actually, hearing this, because you're sort of looking around for the spirit of punk, what that might be now in 2016. And I guess the two obvious names that come to mind are Sleaford Mods and Slaves. Slaves, I think, actually won a Spirit of Punk award. Was it Kerrang or something?
Yeah.
I love the fact they come from Kent, because it's not cool. The last great punk band to come from Kent, as far as I know, were the Anti Nowhere League. And that's, we're talking 35
that's
years.
That's great.
Yeah.
The definition of great there is...
Well, what I like about them, and it's the same as Anti Nowhere League, actually, is that Slaves are kind of uncouth. You know, I think all the things that people dislike about them are the things I like about them.
Yeah.
That they do sound quite kind of obnoxious and vile, and they're not meeting anybody halfway.
Yeah.
You know, and they're quite... I loved Cheer Up London. It's quite a provocation, this album, apparently they're trying to make it their big kind of rock album. They've compared it to Metallica and Slayer, but also trying to have a certain kind of the heart of Black Flag to it. I think working with Mike D from the Beastie Boys is an interesting choice, because the Beasties originally were this kind of scratchy punk band, but they knew that the thing that they needed to get to the next level was to hook up with Rick Rubin and to make this massive rock record, Licensed to Ill.
Yeah.
And I think Slaves have kind of partly achieved that. I wouldn't say it's 100% success, but you know, I'm really glad that they're around.
So that early Beastie Boys thing, because I was a Licensed to Ill kid, and then discovered that there had been records beforehand, bought them, and was horrified, because it's like, Jesus, this is just horrible, noisy punk noise. This sounds like crap discharge kind of thing. I don't know, Jude, what did you reckon?
Oh, see, I'm terrible, because I think it's a good record. I quite like the first record. It was nominated for the Mercury Prize. That's why I first heard it. It was after I was judging, but I was like, oh, I listened to this and thought, oh, that's good. It's good that's on it. Because, you know, records like that don't often get into the Mercury Prize shortlist. And, you know, that can be the death of many bands, you know, none of which are my fault. Speech to Bell. I was listening to this, and I'm just fed up of being angry with everything, which I generally am. So when I hear a record that is about being angry with everything, I just want to listen to some, you know, soft bit of German ambient music from the early 1980s by Radelius or something. It was too intense for me, man. It's good. They're good. It's interesting just thinking about it through. I first heard that the single, and then I heard the album, and then about halfway through, I read about, you know, the Beastie Boys link, and suddenly it made sense. You know, I don't really hear the kind of you know, early 80s hardcore thing in it as much as they're talking about. You know, kind of Black Flag and Minutemen or whoever. Kind of I don't think they mentioned Minutemen, but I don't hear that. It sounds quite contemporary to me, but it's got that sort of. It feels contemporary the same way as when I first heard, you know, the sort of more pop end of the Shouty Beastie Boys in like 87 when I was 9, and I was frightened then as well. It's got that kind of immediacy about it, which I really liked. But I probably wouldn't listen to it a lot, because too angry anyway.
Far be it from me. I mean, you know, there's nothing more dismal to listen to than an old bloke moaning about young people having a good time for the very first time. But I found it quite hard work. The redeeming feature to me is the humour, and the fact that, you know, there's one particular track, the people that you meet walking down the street. It's sort of, you know, half Millwall chant, half Oliver. So much of it felt to me like a parody of punk rock. It's like Ian Rubbish and the Bizarros, if anybody saw them on Saturday Night Live. It's the idea that there's a great lost punk band called Ian Rubbish and the Bizarros, and they were actually Thatcherite punks, and you know, the tune's called Sweet Iron Lady.
Oh, that sounds great.
But it, you know, this to me feels like, you know, I just don't understand why people have to keep resurrecting the spirit of punk.
I think it's a great thing they do. I think that, I mean, you know, I listen to it.
Well, the spirit, but the sound, why so slavishly recreate that sound?
because, you know, what if you're a drummer yeah. and a guitarist, it's really good that you're doing that, I think.
It's quite fun to do,
it's great.
It?
Yeah. It's well, 40 yeah. minutes long, which is the perfect length for an album, and I don't think any album should be longer than 40 minutes. And it's, you know, it's got a bit of Mike D rapping in it, which is quite entertaining. It's got skits, which he must have brought along. Yeah. I've never heard a punk album with skits before.
They are terrible skits.
Which are terrible, but, you know, that's par for the course.
Yeah.
I think there's a real Ian Dury influence, obviously, because Baxter Dury's on it, but his kind of estuary accent has got a bit of bit of the punkier end of the Blockheads in it.
Well, the thing is, this is definitely not for people of our age, is it? If you're 17, this is going to sound fantastic and explosive. But if you are our age, you said casting the net quite wide, it's impossible to get through it without firstly finding, you know, Rich Man, I'm Not Your Bitch Man, finding that a little bit ridiculous.
I love that, man. Come on, that's great.
Yeah.
I could have written it myself.
You would, yeah.
PhDs, STDs. I thought I was good.
That is funny. But also, you know, your mind keeps getting dragged to the songs that sound like these songs, the ones that you know. I heard a lot of the rots in this. You know, there's a bit in Hypnotized where he sings, your mind goes slack, the room goes black, and my internal jukebox then went, you're in a rut, you've got to get out of it. It's too many triggers for old people.
You know what,
warning.
You know, age restriction stickers, you know, that they used to have. May not
parental advisory. Children advisory.
Yeah, may not be sold to people under the age of 18. This should have, may not be sold to people over the age of 24. May not be listened to by people.
Brilliant.
It's not. That's the way it should be. I think.
You ask why it's happening, and I reckon there are economic reasons. Sort of be unromantic about it, but basically,
that's the first time you've ever been unromantic. And what's going on?
There's basically two ways you can make music now. You can go down the kind of tech route where you can make a really lush sounding album on your phone, probably. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not tech savvy enough, but it is possible. Or if you're going to go the analog route, the economics of the music biz now mean that you can't, you know, tour with a huge band. That's why I've got these duos at the moment.
Yeah.
You've got, I guess, the White Stripes started it all off. Then you've had people like Death from Above, 1979, Deep Valley, Royal Blood, of course. Being huge, and Slaves doing it. And now I think that's basically it. That's why making that kind of stripped down music is so appealing right now.
So basically, this is the modern synth duo. This is the equivalent of Erasure and the Pet Shop Boys and Sparks.
It's a poor man's yellow.
It's a poor millionaire's yellow. Well, look, I am absolutely convinced that if you're 14 years old, this is the most exciting thing because you're surrounded by Charlie Puth and James Bay. So good on you. I think I'm just too old for it. But you know, more power to their elbow. Just keep it down in the garage, kids. you're waking me up. Anyway, right. We'll move on. You know, there was a time when everybody in this room would have a pile of records like the ones we just talked about to review every month for the dozens of music magazines that were around. It was the law that every magazine had to say 209 albums reviewed inside on the cover, because apparently readers would only buy the one with the biggest number on the front. So freelancers like us would stagger home with 10 records a month and attempt to differentiate them from one another. Those halcyon days are gone now that streaming has dethroned the record review. But we have two seasoned record reviewers here. Jude Rogers, who used to edit the Word magazine's review section, and Simon Price, the Melody Maker. So we thought we'd dig into the secrets of the dying art of the album review. Well, is it a dying art? Do we think that album reviews are purposeless now?
I don't think they're purposeless. I think the way they use it a lot of the times is just a bit dull. I really like a record review which has a distinctive voice to it. I hate to talk about the Word magazine, but kind of what I really liked about it, they were long reviews, and you could tell that person's interest, specialisms, and then their enthusiasms. A lot of reviews are basically just written as guides for the consumer. You know, there's a formula to them. It's like put it in context of the bands that it's a bit like, mention a few lyrics, you know, bish bash bosh is done really. And
four out of five for everything.
Yeah, and the star system has never been a good thing and is just more and more redundant. I say somebody who did a live review this week, and you know, you're thinking, you know, somebody was having an argument with me on Twitter this morning about, you know, was that Björk gig really, you know, not four stars? I said, well, if it's five stars, surely it's like the greatest gig ever. You know, it's kind of a very messy system, which doesn't really work. But, you know, you can still read really great reviews online. I read a great review of Björk yesterday, the strings version of her last record by Laura Snapes, who's been on this podcast. Really great review. You know, so there's places online where you can find good reviews, but just writing them as a straight consumer guide, you know, do you want to buy this or not? They don't work because people don't buy records.
People don't buy them anymore. Simon, do you miss the good old days of staggering home with a ton of CDs to review?
I sort of do in a way, but I actually welcome the fact that streaming that you mentioned earlier has made certain aspects of record reviewing redundant now.
Yeah.
And they are the aspects that Jude mentioned, in fact, the thing of, oh, just listing the songs. And, yeah, you know, that's what you shouldn't do. You shouldn't just write a list of songs with a description. The readers, less than ever, they don't need that anymore. Mm. What you can offer them, and this sounds really pretentious, but I'm going to say it anyway, is ways of hearing, ways of listening. Because pop doesn't exist in a cultural vacuum. A writer can put it in its context. It can make you think of a record in a way that you might not have thought of it before. I also think that people who try to be too objective are actually pompous and foolish, and it's impossible. I think the only true and honest reaction to art is subjective. However, most magazines don't like that. Most publications will not allow you to use what Mark Ellen describes as the perpendicular pronoun.
Yes.
Now, I can see very good reasons why that should be curtailed, because it can allow people to go off on too much of a me fest.
Yeah.
But there are ways around it. If you're a good writer, you can nevertheless, you can find a way around it of giving something which is clearly a subjective reaction to something. And in a way, that's quite humble, because you're basically saying to the reader, well, look, this is what it did for me. It might not do it for you.
Yeah. Mm. What I used to like about the good old days of a million, what were termed capsule reviews at the back of the magazine, was this is where you got all the best jokes, and loads of them have stuck in my mind for years. David Quantick once in a review of the Bewitched album, wondering what the asterisk in Bewitched stood for. Oh, is the real name of the band Be Fuck Witched? Or Michelle Kirsch, the great Michelle Kirsch, writing about Sinead O'Connor in the very early issues of Select in the early 90s, and her payoff was, we do not want what we have not got to listen to. I do love stories of clangers, though. There was a certain reviewer for Select back in the day who had to go to a playback for a Prince album. The listeners, you may not know this, but you would often be hauled into, because these records were too precious to be allowed out of the record company offices, you'd be hauled into a small room with a cup of tea and some biscuits.
Still happens. Happens sometimes.
Well, now it's streaming, isn't it? Which is even more annoying.
Yeah.
And you'd be forbidden from taking, you'd have to listen to it once and get your review from that. And one of our writers decided he would sneakily record it on his little dictaphone and so he could listen again. Didn't really pay a lot of attention. Came home and wrote up this review about Prince's exciting new hardcore direction with loads of breakbeats and exciting Bomb Squad style production. Submits the copy and then realises that he hadn't pressed record and he'd just reviewed the last Public Enemy album, thinking that it was Prince's new album.
What I find interesting is thinking of albums I've reviewed. Obviously you're reviewing it on like a week's listen if you're lucky. I remember saying the Tender Buttons by the brilliant band Broadcast. I'm kind of saying, it wasn't good, all the other records, blah, 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 real kind of downturn. It's my favourite Broadcast album now. It just took longer to kind of bed in with me. And there's some albums I've given 5 stars to, and they're not 5-star albums. It's funny how I find it really interesting, and the older I get, and when I do live reviewing now a lot, and I don't do much record reviewing anymore by choice, because it's really hard. It's you know when you go to certain gigs that everyone's going to give something a 5-star review almost before it. I once reviewed Kate Bush for Pitchfork, and you just know everybody there's it's going to be 5 stars.
Yeah.
And it sort of was it was great, but it wasn't 5 stars. They were saying her voice was amazing and it was never up to tune. It was at some points, but it's natural because she hasn't sung for a long time, and there's this kind of like homogenous kind of pull of wanting to be like everybody else in reviewing a bit now, which I don't like.
I hate that. This is why I try and avoid reading other people's reviews until after I've written mine. Yeah. And even if I've been to a gig alongside fellow journalists, if I'm sat next to them on the train home, I'll try and change the subject, talk about anything other than the gig, because I don't want my view to be influenced by theirs or vice versa. Yeah.
Absolutely.
If you live in Brighton and you're at a gig in London, it's a well known fact that you can tell when the last Brighton train is going home, because you'll see Simon's horns passing through the crowd.
Me and Alexis Petridis all charging to the barriers.
Absolutely. Follow Simon or you miss your last train home. One more of the great things I remember reading in the Golden Age of Record Reviews is Dave Kavanagh once describing something as sounding like LSD on acid. I just thought it was such a great line.
It's good.
Yeah. Simon, there must have been other clangers that took place at Melody Makeup, people reviewing the wrong record, playing it at the wrong speed.
I know you mentioned hip-hop albums, the way that they're often sent out. There was a phase, I don't know if it still happens in the days of streaming, but there was a phase when you get a tape and every sort of 20 seconds or so you get an announcement saying, this is the new album by so-and-so. Yeah.
Promo copy.
Yeah, it's kind of like an anti-bootlegging device. A colleague of mine, Dave Bennon, actually reviewed an album thinking that that was part of the art, that was part of it. Interesting kind of slightly egotistical approach taken by this rapper to remind you even more than is the norm for rappers, who they are.
I've got a good few of them when it was very much vogue in the noughties, and there's a particular Roots Maneuver album where they got, do you remember that the artificial speaking voice on the Mac that sounded a little bit like Stephen Hawkins and a little bit like a sexy alien robot, and it just kept saying Roots Maneuver, Banana Clan, promo, and it actually made the music loads better. Banana Clan, you know, it sounded like a deliberate sort of inclusion into the whole thing. Do we think, well, are we going to miss the capsule review when it disappears, when everything's simply, you know, like, oh, you know, listen to it on a forwarded playlist?
Got to be careful what I say now. I'm a freelance journalist. Yeah. I don't particularly miss them personally because I like the longer reviews with, you know, more opinion, more personality. And I always have really. I really like long reviews that combine, like, you know, reviewing four or five records. That's what I really like. You know, kind of new perspectives, you know, ways of hearing. That's absolutely what I think the purpose of the review is about. And that is about length now, I think.
I'd say fewer and longer is the way for reviews. Because at the moment, you know, a lot of the reviews I write, they're 100 words, even 80 words long sometimes. By the time you've got in there, said who the band are, whether this is their second or third album, and, you know, named a couple of songs, you're out. You've got to have your zinger for the final line. You know, once you've thrown in a few channelings and a few esques, you're done.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's time for our zingers and closing lines now, because we're coming to the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. This is the ideas or stories or features or arguments or anything that have been obsessing our guests this week. Jude, you mentioned Bjork a minute ago. I believe you are obsessed with Bjork this week.
I'm just really into the jellyfish outfit she wore at the gig this week, which was amazing. It kind of lit up in the dark in the Royal Albert Hall. It's fantastic. And I was just thinking about costumes on stage and animal costumes, more of it. You know, it's funny, if she does it as a jellyfish, everybody laughs. Flaming Lips of Bears and British Sea Power, Have a Bear.
Have a bear.
And nobody, bear. Nobody is critical then.
Simon, I believe aliens have been on your mind for a change.
Yeah, I was one of those kids who was fascinated by space as a child. But as a teenager, I became less and less science-y. So I feel a little bit out of my depth discussing this stuff now. And I'm not one of those kind of sci-fi geeks. But there is something brewing now. I don't know if you've seen in the news that NASA are going to make some big announcement on Monday, and perhaps a lot of people listening to this podcast, they may have already made the announcement by that time.
It's all about Europa, isn't it?
Yes, it's about Europa, which is one of the moons of Jupiter. And all they've said so far is that there are signs of, in inverted commas, surprising activity. Now, what we know about Jupiter is that it's mostly frozen, and they believe there may be an ocean underneath the ice.
Inside Europa,
yeah. Yeah, and the theory is that there may be something, you know, down there. Now, in a way, I think our idea of what aliens could be has been sort of distorted and maybe unfairly, you know, elevated by sci-fi, that we all think they're going to be bipedal creatures with eyes and heads and mouths that can talk and communicate. To me, I don't care about that. To me, if it's a microbe, if it's a bit of moss or lichen or something like that, that is as mind. Why is that not mind blowing? That is hugely mind blowing that something that qualifies as life may exist, not even in a different solar system. We've heard that thing about Proxima Centauri being an Earth-like world that, you know, could possibly be inhabited. But even within our solar system, if there are two planets or, you know, bodies which can sustain life, our own and Neptune, what does that tell us about the rest of the universe?
It means it's lousy with life, teeming, filthy with
absolutely.
It. Matt?
There was a conference that took place in Boston this week, which was dedicated to the instant messaging and texting generation and industry. And there was a fact that somebody tweeted that was there, somebody I follow. And the fact was that the average millennial employee sends 109 texts per day during their workday. And 75% prefer messaging to the phone. And the reason for this is because they can, and then also a quote saying, myself and my generation, we do not use email for personal communications. Email is for work, chat is for friends. Interesting things going on that I think there's a theory that people enabling to stratify their relationships. So you have one set of friends that you only talk to on Instagram. You have another set really close that you only instant message through through your kind of phone or whatever, and then you have another set that you a wider set that you talk to on Twitter, and a different subset that you talk to on Facebook, and none of those are people that you work with.
I'm just amazed that there's 109 things to say in the course of a day.
Half of them are emojis, and the rest are kind of retweets
just sending the poo emoji to each other over and over again. Well, my closing time chatter is the BBC putting all of its shows out to tender inside the next 11 years. You may have seen that A Question of Sport, Songs of Praise and Holby City are going to be put out to tender to be made by independent production companies. Who cares, you might say. I don't watch those programmes. Well, the fact is that the government has proposed that the BBC puts 100% of its shows out for competition, with the exception of news and current affairs, to be made by independent production companies. And this frightens me, because I don't want to see Doctor Who made by the people who made Hollyoaks. In one respect, it's the end of the BBC. It's the end of in-house programme making, because inside 11 years, absolutely everything will be out for tender, and I'm concerned about it. There goes your BBC. But if Big Mouth gets to make Doctor Who, then who cares? Nick Cave was the Doctor. Anyway, that's our show. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our two spectacular guests, Jude Rogers and Simon Price. If you like Big Mouth, tell your friends, share a link to our podcast, or go to our Facebook page, where you'll be able to read many of the stories that we've discussed in various past episodes, including Simon's fantastic up-and-coming Ramones feature. Don't forget, you can hear all this and all our other shows at audioboom.com/channels/Big Mouth. And if you want to subscribe, then go to iTunes, go to the podcast section of the iTunes Music Store, search for Big Mouth. You can subscribe there, and you can also give us a star rating, which, even though we've just been slagging off star ratings, very, very helpful to us, gets us on the front page and stuff like that. We'll be back next week with more handcrafted artisan blather about pop culture and all of its work. In the meantime, have a lovely week.